I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times.
When someone is cruel or acts like a bully, you don't stoop to their level. No, our motto is, when they go low, we go high.
But Michelle says that, you know, when they go low, we go high. No, no. When they go low, we kick them.
Here's a guy throwing punches, nasty as hell, screaming at everything else when we're talking. And he's walking out, and we're not allowed, you know, the guards are very gentle with him. He's walking out like big high fives, smiling, laughing, like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
You cannot be civil with a political party that wants to destroy what you stand for, what you care about. That's why I believe if we are fortunate enough to win back the House and or the Senate, that's when civility can start again.
Well, Governor Wolf, let me tell you, between now and November 6th, you better put a catcher's mask on your face, because I'm going to stomp all over your face with golf spikes, because I'm going to win this for the state of Pennsylvania, and we're throwing you out of office.
And if you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd, and you push back on them, and you tell them they're not welcome.
That was former First Lady Michelle Obama, former Attorney General Eric Holder, candidate Donald Trump, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Pennsylvania Republican gubernatorial candidate Scott Wagner, and California Representative Maxine Waters, a sampling of the angry and frustrated voices we hear these days about our politics. And chances are you're feeling the same way. We asked Diana Musk to join us. She's director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics at the University of Pennsylvania, where she's the Samuel S. Stauffer Chair in Political Science and Communication, author of several books, including In Your Face Politics, The Consequences of Uncivil Media. Diana Musk, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, nice to be here.
So why is everyone so angry?
Because there's an election coming up, and we have highly polarized political parties at the moment. And I think it's easy for us to look at this and think of it as something totally new, but in reality, politicians have always been uncivil to one another, and we see a lot more of it these days due to cell phone cameras and coverage of uncivil incidents that go viral and so forth. But this has pretty much always been a part of politics in the United States.
But you're saying that the fact that there is so much media around us, or we're so plugged into our media, that it feels a lot more uncivil than perhaps it has been in the past?
Yes, I think we see, and as in we witness a lot more of the incivility because media are everywhere. There's 24/7 news. That obviously wasn't the case. And, you know, I'm certain, virtually certain, that people like Jefferson and Adams were rude and uncivil to each other as well. But the chances that the mass public would see those interactions is very, very small. Today, it's very likely any kind of uncivil interaction will get coverage, and will get coverage that spreads to many different people and many different sources. It inherently attracts our attention when we hear incivility, and that's something we all intuitively know. I think, you know, if we can't get our spouse's attention, we raise our voice. And we know that it's a means of getting attention, and yet it still surprises us when we hear it from political leaders, where perhaps we expect a different degree of decorum.
Well, let me pick up on that and ask you about our president, President Trump, known for his intemperate words, for his name-calling, frankly, his insults. Last night, he was in Montana, and he praised Representative Gianforte for body-slamming a reporter, something that Gianforte actually pled guilty to last year. Have we ever had a president who's been so outspoken, so publicly outspoken in his incivility?
Not that I'm aware of. Someone who, you know, overtly advocates violent acts of the kind that are, you know, illegal, that's not something that I have come across before. He's obviously set a new standard in the kinds of things he's willing to say. And the interesting thing, though, is that his supporters will say, oh, well, you know, it's just a figure of speech and so forth. And they're right. There is a certain amount of uncivil language that is expressive. When I say I'd like to punch that guy in the face, I don't mean I'm really going to punch the guy in the face. I mean I'm angry with him, and that is a way of expressing emotion. But usually people in positions of leadership, like the president, are more careful in how they put things. And I think part of what's happened is there's so much competition for Americans' attention these days that we've kind of upped the ante. Each person has to uncivil the next in order to get the most media attention. And it works. I mean, that's the sad part of it.
Well, and I want to pick up on that, because what I heard from Hillary Clinton, she didn't exactly talk about fighting back, but she said perhaps when or if the Democrats win at least a branch of the government, we can go back to being civil again. But we heard Eric Holder talking about what we do is we go low. I should add that after that, he said, I don't actually mean stomp them in the face, but nonetheless, the people there seem to appreciate what he was saying. I hear the Democrats trying to figure out what to do about some of this incivil language.
Sure, it's a bit of an arms race, and with each level of incivility we reach seems to be an all-time new high. And I do think we, you know, have created a situation where there's just intense competition for our attention, for our eyeballs. And that's true on the internet, it's true on television, and it's true in print as well. So we are drawn to those things. That doesn't mean we like incivility or that we necessarily advocate it in our political leaders, but it does get our attention, and it's hard to get around that. So I do, you know, this is not new in the sense that, of course, people have done this, you know, for hundreds of years to get attention, is to scream and yell and do things that are uncivil. So that part is not new, but the intensity, that the competitive media environment combined with polarized politics has created is really very shocking to many of us, and that's what it's intended to be. Shocking means we pay attention, we talk about it, and we relay those snippets of incivility to others to say, can you believe what so-and-so just said?
Well, I'm curious about whether we're talking also about just how we are, we meaning us human beings, are built to react to things that we see as angry or maybe even threatening.
Yes, I think we are built that way, and certainly evolutionary psychology suggests that when we are exposed to incivility, even when it's just on the television screen, our level of physiological arousal goes up. I mean, we show all the signs of fight or flight. We are seeing it as threatening, and we are preparing to react in some way, and that's very adaptive when those kinds of threats are, you know, tigers and lions and things that we really do need to run away from, or fight. But that's not the case, obviously, in listening to most politicians, although many would argue that that arousal gets transferred into enthusiasm for one's political views and a desire to get out and vote and be involved and so forth. So all arousal is not bad. You know, it gets our attention and it causes us to take action. But, it sure does sound horrible.
Well, do you think Republicans and Democrats then have replaced the tigers and lions?
Pretty much, yes. In the political world, we are all tigers and lions to one another. And I think, you know, right before an election in particular, I think back to various election years, and there's always a great deal of discussion of intensely negative advertising and incivility right before an election. Things always heat up. So I do think after the election is over, things will calm down some regardless of the outcome. But this has been a very different kind of presidency, and I think it has aroused not just Trump supporters, but those who are opposed to Trump as well. So it's not surprising that we see incivility on both sides.
Do you think it's equal on both sides?
You know, I don't really have a metric to tell you, and I think, so I don't know. I mean, I think Trump obviously is somebody who's highly uncivil, who has a lot of media attention. So we certainly see a lot of it on the Republican side by means of him. But he's one person. Can we say that all Republicans are more uncivil? No, obviously not. It's very hard to say, and it's hard to say because we not all Republicans get covered an equal amount as Democrats do and so forth. So, yeah, I wouldn't venture a claim on how much incivility is on one side versus another. But often, you know, opposing something is something that involves incivility more than status quo does. So if you look at things like the civil rights movement, you know, trying to change things often requires a lot of incivility to get attention.
What are the risks, though? As you say, incivility is there's nothing new about it, but what do you see as the risks?
Well, one of the risks that I find evidence of in my own research is that although it seldom changes anyone's views about which candidate they support or anything like that, it does turn people off on politicians. People have an idea of how, you know, normal, decent people act in day-to-day life. And the way politicians act and the level of incivility that we see in the political world is nothing like our everyday lives. It's far more uncivil. And there's a tendency for people to say, oh, politicians, you can't trust them, they act like a bunch of idiots, and they're not, you know, decent human beings because of how they act. You know, it's surprising in a way because we know that how they act is partly a function of when the cameras are on and those kinds of things. It's for the audience, and it's a far more uncivil performance than would occur if we weren't, if the media weren't there watching them. Nonetheless, it's something that we respond to at a gut level because it's not what we're accustomed to. Most people don't act this way, and most neighbors who disagree about politics don't scream and yell at each other over the fence. They manage to get along, and whether it's by not talking about politics at all or by talking about it in more muted ways, in either case, there's the appearance of a great deal more social harmony among everyday Americans than among politicians.
Diana, we have about 45 seconds here, but do you see the media then as enablers?
Absolutely. Media need audiences, and incivility helps them get audiences. So, they definitely are enablers of this by covering it as well.
By covering it and keeping people, charged up?
Yes, exactly. But there's a flip side. I mean, people are going to be more jazzed about getting involved politically if you get them aroused like that as well.
Well, I appreciate you joining us once again on Radio Times. Diana Mutz, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And she is director of the Institute for the Study of Citizens and Politics at the University of Pennsylvania, wrote a book a couple of years ago, In Your Face Politics, The Consequences of Uncivil Media. And we have sitting across from me, waiting very patiently, Joanne Freeman. She's got a new book called The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War. That's our conversation after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Many of us know about the infamous caning that took place in the U.S. Congress in 1856. That was when Representative Preston Brooks of South Carolina brutally beat Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner within an inch of his life over an anti-slavery speech. What we probably don't know is how common fighting was in Congress in the few decades leading up to the Civil War. Our guest Joanne Freeman writes in her new book, The Field of Blood, that there were 70 violent incidents involving members of Congress between 1830 and 1860. We're talking about fistfights and duels and bullying and brandishing weapons. The public filled the galleries to watch the arguments, the physical altercations, and the free-for-alls. Joanne Freeman joins us on Radio Times to talk about this combative and important period in our history and what it tells us about our country. She's professor of history and American studies at Yale University, co-host of the history podcast, Backstory. Joanne Freeman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm segueing from our first guest to you. Are we then in a relatively civil period compared to the 19th century?
Well, I suppose you could say perhaps yes. I mean, the people who I write about in Congress are armed. So that's a different level of, I suppose you could say, incivility than we're looking at now. But I guess I would sort of say there's a spectrum of behavior that we might deem unacceptable. And I would say incivility can mean a lot of things.
Sure.
And violence isn't the same thing as incivility.
Well, let's go back to our violent past. And you look at these couple of decades before the Civil War. Obviously, we're a relatively new country. But as you write, we're also a very violent country, not just inside the halls of Congress, but out among the people.
Absolutely. And that's particularly true in the 19th century, the early 19th century. This was an era of rioting, naturalization rioting, anti-immigrant rioting, all kinds of things that particularly in urban environments, people were angry about and they would have violent protest about it. Obviously, the institution of slavery was violent in and of itself. So, yeah, America was an exceedingly violent nation at that time.
Including what we did to the American Indians.
Precisely.
You talk about, you write about the, I love these names, the Plug Uglies, the Chunkers, and the Rip-Raps.
Indeed.
Who were they?
They were these gangs. So this was also an era of gang violence in a different sense, but related, I suppose, in some sense to what we might think about in modern times. These were gangs. Often they were anti-immigrant gangs who acted out in violence, particularly at election time.
Let's talk about this man, Benjamin Brown French, who really created the kind of core of your book. He was a diarist. He wrote many diaries over between, say, 1830 and 1870. So he's your view into this world.
He absolutely was. He kind of saved my life because I had a very hard time figuring out how to tell the story because I found at least 70 incidents, and each one could be a chapter. So then the question becomes, how do I tell this story? Well, French is a minor clerk in Congress. For a little while, he's the clerk, but mostly he's just a clerk. And he comes to Washington in 1833. He dies in Washington in 1870, so he's there during the whole course of the time I write about, and he's always in or watching Congress. And he has this amazing 11-volume diary
wow.
in which he describes, it's not a boring diary, so it's not the kind where he says, I had lunch with Mr. Smith and it's raining outside. I mean, he really describes what he thinks and feels about what's going on. And in the diary and in the book, you really see him change from 1833 when he's trying to appease everybody to 1860 when he's ready to shoot people.
Is he a kind of Forrest Gump in that he was sort of where the action was?
He is absolutely. I sort of alternately think of him as Zelig or Forrest Gump.
Right, I
but
know.
One
I
way
was
or another.
Debating between those two characters.
Yes,
right.
And I can never decide myself. But he is. He's if something happens in this period, somehow right. Benjamin Brown French is there. So someone tries to assassinate Andrew Jackson. Who's watching? Benjamin Brown French. Gettysburg Address. Who's up on the stage while it's being delivered? Benjamin Brown French. John Quincy Adams has a stroke in the House of Representatives. Who's holding his hand? Benjamin Brown French. So when I was writing the book, I really thought that people were going to think that I invented him.
Well, I wonder, is he a reliable witness and narrator? I mean, obviously, we're depending on his observations of what was going on. How do you fact check someone like that?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. So on the one hand, I would say he's accurate in that part of what I was interested in were his feelings and how he was feeling about what was happening around him. And in that sense, yes, you know, I took him on face value. But on the other hand, you're absolutely right that particularly given the strong feelings, you have to fact check what he's saying. And that's part of what took me so long to write the book was when you have people who are so, and actually we're seeing this now, so heated about what's going on, there are such high political stakes, there are such different views about what should or shouldn't be, you absolutely have to triangulate and fact check and weigh sources against each other. And so I was constantly looking at French's diaries and the periods equivalent to the Congressional Record and newspaper databases and trying to piece together some sense of what actually happened.
How much was liquor involved? Drinking involved?
liquor was involved a lot.
A lot. There, yes. People, I think, don't realize how much drinking there was in early America.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, there was extreme. As a matter of fact, French, when Benjamin Brown French arrives in Washington, it's one of the first things, because he's from a little small town in New Hampshire. He gets to Washington, and one of the first things he says is, there's like a bar on every corner of Washington. But it was a huge impact. And his diary and many, many other accounts show, you know, congressmen too drunk to stand, congressmen who are too drunk to leave their boarding house. And obviously, sometimes that played a role in what was going on the floor.
You also describe, and probably based on his accounts and other people's accounts, of what it was like to be a spectator, and also what it was like, I guess, in a room or a hall of Congress where the windows were shut. It was packed with people, tobacco spitting on the floor. Who knows else what was going on the floor as well? What was that like?
Well, right. And that was one of the interesting things early on in the project. I think we have an image of the 19th century Congress of this sort of staid, serious place with men in these sort of black frock coats standing around with their fingers in the air saying noble things, right? And what I found very early on was, particularly the House, you know, the country was initially much smaller than it ended up being very quickly because of expansion, westward expansion, the addition of new states, and more representatives. The House of Representatives became jam-packed with people. It was stuffy. It was, I think at one point they did a climate test and discovered it was like 30 degrees warmer inside than it was outside. It was stinky. You know, I'm sure there was a lot of body odor. There was tobacco spitting. I mean, it was really not a pleasant place to be, and it was loud. So the idea that there are people pontificating in the House with these sort of, you know, stemwinder speeches, it was a really different kind of a climate.
Well, let's talk about some of the people that you write about. One, John B. Dawson from Louisiana. Carried a Bowie knife and a pistol.
He did.
Bad-tempered fellow.
He did. Even, you know, so even his friends and allies, when he finally dies in the eulogy, they say, well, he did have certain grave faults. But he's a fascinating character, and he's very little known. The fact of the matter is I had a very hard time tracking him down.
Right.
He's not someone who had a major political career, but he was definitely someone who was known to be what in Congress at the time they would have called a fighting man. So he was armed, and he let it be known that he was armed, and if he didn't like what you were doing, he waved a weapon at you and threatened to use it.
Wow. Did he ever use it? Any of those weapons?
Well, he certainly cocked his gun at a speaker from Ohio who was attacking slavery. One of the interesting things is, you know, if you're someone who's a slaveholder or from a part of the union that endorses slavery, in Congress, you're confronting anti-slavery talk to a degree that you probably haven't in your life up until that point. And Dawson, who has unnamed grave problems, certainly had outrage when anyone dared speak against slavery. And so there's one account of him standing up and cocking his gun. And I think someone heard him mumble, you know, I'm going to kill that damn guy or something. Mm. And some friends came and stood by his side to support him. And some friends came and stood by the side of the speaker. And they also were armed to support him. So you can kind of see how this sort of thing could spiral.
Well, there was dueling, of course, besides fist fights. Jonathan, is it Silley, C-I-L-L-E-Y,
yes,
and William Graves? Help us understand what happened between these two men.
So that's an amazing incident that I end up writing a whole chapter about. These two men actually had no personal grievance with each other. They liked each other fine. They're relatively new to Congress. They end up fighting a duel with each other, and one of them kills the other. And I use that as an episode because, to me, you can really see through their example how people are pulled into the violence and pulled into fighting even if they don't want to fight. And it partly has to do with the fact that there's an audience, there's a national audience, there's an audience of their peers. It partly has to do with the pressure of party politics. That chapter of the book and that incident in and of itself really shows you the power of fighting and rhetoric and words and sort of the weight of politics and how violence can sort of present itself, particularly in this time period, and be very hard to back away from.
Well, this is not giving anything away. Graves kills Silley.
Yes, Graves does kill Silley.
And it was over charges or allegations of corruption?
Right, but vague allegations of corruption, right? So a Virginia congressman comes into the House waving a newspaper and says, this newspaper says that the Democrats are corrupt. And Silley, who's a Democrat, stands up and says, how dare you? How dare you say that about my party? And the Virginian does what many Southerners do in this period, immediately makes it personal to shut up the Northerner. And so he says, are you suggesting I'm lying? Are you mm-hmm. saying something personal about me? And it rapidly becomes a nasty conversation. Poor Silly, in the course of that conversation, insults the newspaper editor who put in the newspaper the charge of corruption. The editor comes riding from New York to Washington to defend his name. Poor Graves agrees, because he's friendly with the newspaper editor, to deliver a letter from him to Silly. And one thing leads to another, and you end up with this duel between two men who had nothing to do with each other at the beginning of the incident.
You write some really interesting things about this clash of cultures, especially when it came to something like dueling, and that the North had a very different code of honor, if I can put it that way, compared to the South. Help us understand that.
Absolutely. And French at one point handily refers to Yankee honor. So part of what I suggest in the book is it's not as though honor culture only exists in the South, or only the South is violent. It's really that there are kind of different dialects of these things in different parts of the country. And so part of what becomes interesting in Congress is that Northerners are great with rioting, but they're not so big on man-to-man violence of the sort that dueling is. And one of the questions that I was intrigued with when I began the project is, so what happens when you put people in one body, one institution? They have to deal with really fraught political issues, and they have very different ideas about lawfulness and lawlessness and fighting and how that works. And the Southerners know that because they're willing to duel, and because Northerners by this point are condemning it, they have a real advantage.
Wow.
And they can stand up and suggest that they might be intrigued with fighting a duel, or bully them in some other way. And Northerners in this period, the word for the time that they called them was noncombatants. Most Northerners were noncombatants.
And that was an insult, I guess.
It was descriptive. It was meant to be descriptive. A Southerner would ask, are you a noncombatant? Because that would indicate how he would treat him. But Southerners realized very quickly that they had a cultural advantage in Congress, that they could bully Northerners, and Northerners, worried about what their constituents would think of them and not quite sure how to deal with that situation, often backed down. And so Southerners end up with a really outsized influence in Congress.
That is Joanne Freeman. We're talking about her new book. It's called The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War. And the Capitol was known as the Field of Blood because of all the fighting that happened there between members of Congress. You can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. You include, this was something that I guess was written in a newspaper in the North related to this murder of Silly. And they write, it's tiny writing, so I hope I can make my way through this. We wish our government would now take dueling in hand and pass a law to expel this practice from our land. This murderous practice has prevailed long in the southern states, and many have been called to mourn of ancient and modern dates. Our northern people all disdain this cursed practice here. They call it honor, exclamation point, but to use no honor doth appear.
Really interesting, and really, obviously, in the context of Congress, political.
Right.
You know, John Quincy Adams, who remarkably, after he's president, he then goes on to serve in the House of Representatives. At one point, he stands up and talks explicitly about dueling. And he says, look, because of dueling, Southerners trample the rules of this House, and they can do it. Because they have their own code. We don't approve of that code. And the imbalance is unfair, and something needs to happen. There needs to be laws and rules passed, which, of course, Southerners giggle at. But that issue of there being this imbalance of power is a very real one.
You also write about a guy named Joshua Giddings. He was an abolitionist, and he seemed like an abolitionist who was willing to fight back.
He was. So here's the interesting thing. If you think about the climate that I'm talking about, if you're going to be an outspoken abolitionist, you're going to have a strategy for dealing with the climate. And there are different ways of dealing with it. And there's a fellow from New Hampshire named John Parker Hale who uses humor to kind of diffuse the environment and very often deflates attackers. Joshua Giddings from Ohio really uses his willingness to fight. And in the book, I call him an abolitionist toreador,
because, yes, you do. Right.
Which makes me happy. because what he does is he deliberately provokes these Southerners, knowing that they're going to run at him or attack him or insult him or charge at him, lose their cool. And he then essentially can step aside and say, ladies and gentlemen of America, the barbaric South. So again and again, they demonstrate their violence and their culture in a way that Giddings thinks really proves his anti-slavery point.
I wonder how this then plays out in the North and the South. I mean, we haven't obviously started the Civil War yet, but nonetheless, how do these two cultures get expressed?
Well, for a time, part of what's interesting is that in the North, well, actually in the North and the South, for a time, a lot of the violence is not detailed in the press. So for a time, the American public isn't getting a full dose of what's going on in Congress. They know some, and they can see the bravado, and they can see their congressmen sort of standing up and holding forth. But very often what gets put in the equivalent of the record is a very smoothed over, prettified version, if anything. And a lot of the kind of behavior I write about in the book is not really there at all.
So what we get is the finger in the air, but we don't get the punch.
Exactly.
And were presidents drawn into these battles?
So sometimes presidents were drawn in. Not surprisingly, Andrew Jackson is a president that involves himself in that culture. He actually invents a word as part of his involvement in this fighting culture. So there was Sam Houston, the sort of well-known Sam Houston. At one point, canes one of Jackson's opponents in the streets in Washington, a fellow named Stanberry. And years later, there are two congressmen who Jackson is particularly angry at. And he says in a group full of people, you know what needs to happen to those two men? They need to be Houstonized. Which is funny and horrible at the same time.
Yes, it is.
But certainly, he was essentially calling for a supporter to do something to those two congressmen, and they armed because they understood precisely what that meant.
Almost up in a break here, you mentioned John Quincy Adams. Was he able to stay largely out of the fray?
Adams was. So he was elderly. He was a former president. He was the son of a founder and a former president. So he was essentially bulletproof. He could not be beaten. Ah. And he knew that. And he played that to its full advantage, basically saying things that really aggressively attacked slavery and then turning to the Southerners and essentially saying, bring it on. Bring it on. You don't dare attack me. And they didn't.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Joanne Freeman. Again, she's got a new book called The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War. It's about the fights and duels in the couple of decades before the Civil War in the 19th century. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Let me just recap here. Well, if you think we are living in angry times now, let's go back to the 19th century, the few decades before the Civil War, when members of Congress were beating each other up on the floors of the House and Senate, fighting duels over insults and disagreements. Our guest, Joanne Freeman, explores this contentious and pivotal time in our country's history in her new book called The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War. And as we have been talking about, and as she says in this book, it was a violent time across antebellum America with roaming mobs, the expulsion of Native Americans, and the war with Mexico. And she's a history professor at Yale University. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jack has a question. When was the last duel in Congress, and is it illegal to duel now?
Oh, excellent question. Okay. Well, interestingly, it was illegal to duel then, which it doesn't seem that way. But actually, pretty much from the dawn of the Republic, lawmakers, the people making the anti-dueling laws, were also dueling. And they assumed...
Why am I not surprised?
I know. It's shocking. I realize.
Yes, exactly.
They assumed that they had that right because they were the political elite, and thus they assumed that they had special privileges, and they used them. And indeed, they got away with much of what they were doing. A lot of the behavior that I write about in this book, there's no punishment of any kind, really. As far as the last duel in Congress, there are a lot of duel threats in the 1850s. I think there's one in the 1840s. What's interesting about dueling, I mean, we assume that dueling is about killing. But what dueling is really about is proving that you're willing to die for your name and reputation. more than anything else, and in politics, obviously, your reputation means everything. So negotiating a duel can be a mode of campaigning. And so a lot of what's going on when people are flaunting dueling, they're either trying to bully people into silence or they're trying to promote themselves. So there's a lot of dueling negotiation that doesn't end up leading to the dueling ground, but is no less powerful in the impact that it has.
A Mississippi senator, a man named Henry Foote, four duels he was involved in, actual dueling, and he was actually wounded three times, right?
He was.
Back for more.
Yes, he was an irritable character, Henry Foote.
Well, in fact, someone has a little ditty about him. Grave senators should never let their angry passions rise. Their little hands were never made to scratch each other's eyes.
Right. He gets involved in what in the time they called a scratch fight on the streets of Washington.
How many words maybe we don't use today were used back in the 19th century to describe the kind of fighting we've been talking about?
Oh, there are a lot of wonderful words. I mean, for a while, sometimes it was a challenge to figure out how many ways can I say fight. You know, battle, rencontre,
clash. This is
you
the
clash.
Writer, right?
Yes, as the writer. I'm like, I can't say fight 100 million times. But there were wonderful words in the period. And I think my all-time favorite is a phrase that was used in particular in one incident in which a congressman almost bit the thumb off of a reporter who displeased him. But the way that was described was that the reporter's thumb was, quote, catawampously chawed up.
Catawampously
chawed up. Yes, which is just a wonderful word that I think has to come back into vogue because it's just too wonderful sounding.
Well, trademark, branding, whatever it takes to get that
exactly.
back into the vocabulary. I do want to talk about Sumner Brooks, and that's probably a fight that we're most familiar with. But there's also a Pennsylvania Republican, a guy named Galusha Grow. I'd never heard of him. What do we need to know about him?
First of all, is that not a wonderful 19th century name?
Perfect.
Galusha Grow. But he's an interesting character. So he's a Republican. He's a very aggressive politician. And he's in Congress in the late 1850s at a time when if you're going to be anti-slavery and Republican and a Northerner, you need to be an aggressive politician. So he becomes involved in a fight in 1858 that for people at the time stood out as something that didn't seem like the fights that came before. And the way that plays out is he was standing amidst a bunch of Southerners and objected to something, and another Southerner named Lawrence Kitt from South Carolina got upset and basically said, go do that in your own darn side of the house. And Grow said, I can do that wherever I want. I don't have to listen to some whip-driving slaveholder. And so Kitt grabbed Grow by the collar and Grow slugged him and knocked Kitt flat. And at that particular moment, when Southerners saw that one of their fellows had been knocked flat, heaven forbid, by a Northerner, a Northern anti-slavery advocate, they began streaming across the house, to some of them probably to save their fellow, some of them to attack Grow. When Republicans saw that happening, they began running across the house, jumping over desks and chairs to get to the point of conflict to save Grow. And you end up with a huge brawl in the space before the speaker's chair with armed groups of Northerners and Southerners physically attacking each other.
Armed meaning?
Carrying knives and guns.
Wow.
And so, you know, at the time, reporters who saw that incident said, you know, usually the fights that happen here are a handful of guys and they flip a desk or they get tangled in seats. This looked like a battle.
Right.
People at the time understood that was a kind of a marker that what had been fighting now was taking on a dangerous kind of a group dynamic.
Was it also that perhaps Northern voters wanted to send people to Congress who were willing to literally fight Southern representatives?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's the rise of the 19th century Republican Party largely is bound up with this, in that you have Northerners not fighting back and the Republican anti-slavery Northern Party rises up and says, we're going to fight the slave power. And in Congress, that they mean that literally and they act on that literally. And when you look at newspapers and at the congressional record, again and again and again, you see Northerners stand up and say, we're a different kind of Northerner now. We're a Northerner that's going to fight back. And so absolutely, the Northerners, as things are getting more tense, are beginning to vote people into Congress who they want to explicitly fight for their rights.
Fight back, but also fight for a just cause. Is the
absolutely.
Issue of slavery then beginning to become more stark?
It's the issue of slavery, but related to that, it's also the issue of their rights, right? Northerners and John Quincy Adams plays this up big time. Northerners assumed increasingly that Southerners were silencing their representatives on the floor and destroying their representative rights. And of course, for people who didn't particularly care about slavery, and there were those people in the North, having their own rights impinged upon, that mattered. And Adams knew that, and which is why he played it up. He knew that that would grab at people who weren't upset by the practice of slavery. So in one way or another, Northerners are beginning to feel personally implicated in what's going on.
This is 1856, and this is, of course, the infamous fight. Charles Sumner, Massachusetts senator, is beaten by Representative Preston Brooks of South Carolina, beaten with a cane. This is probably the one example of violence that folks, listeners, probably have some awareness of, but maybe not the full story.
Well, absolutely. And I will say it took me 17 years to write the book because it was so hard to find the violence. But in that 17-year period, whenever I said I'm writing a book on physical violence in the U.S. Congress, people would always know, well, there was that guy.
Yeah.
That guy who was hit. It was like, yes, there was the guy. And that's, of course, abolitionist Senator Charles Sumner.
But beaten badly. I mean, to the point where the Brooks's cane broke.
He beat him until the cane broke. Absolutely. No, it was a really severe beating. The desks in the Senate were bolted to the ground. And so Sumner, who was seated at his Senate desk, couldn't get away, couldn't stand up. He ultimately wrenched the bolts out of the ground in his effort to get away from that beating. But in that time, in that amount of time, he was really severely beaten.
So this all, you know, with the advantage of hindsight, it leads us to the Civil War. Do you think the fighting then in Congress before the Civil War, in a sense, set the stage? It was the preamble to the fighting on battlefields?
Well, I do think sometimes it's tempting to see politics and the lead up to the war and the war as two different things. And I for one thing, don't think that that's the case. And I think the fighting shows that. It shows a deep history of sectional violence. It shows violence and politics being linked together in all kinds of dangerous ways. And it shows you the national psyche sort of being played out on the floor of Congress. I mean, Congress really is a representative institution. It also inspires Americans to want their congressmen to fight. And when Americans begin seeing the other side as the other and wanting their representatives to attack the other, that's obviously a dangerous phenomenon, and Congress is part of that, and the press is part of that.
But it also does it also say that they're fighting, and they're in is an example of their inability to prevent the Civil War, or was the Civil War, it was going to happen no matter what was going to happen, what was in Congress because of slavery?
Well, you know, so there's a theory. Some historians in the past have said that, you know, the Civil War happened because there were a bunch of blundering politicians who couldn't figure out how not to have a civil war. And I don't think that's true. And I think the fact that the fighting is going on forever is partly an indication of that. What you have going on there is much deeper than a handful of guys who somehow didn't manage to not fight. It really was an enormous clash of fundamental assumptions about what the United States should be. And I think in American history, when you take the very broad overview, there are moments. I mean, I think, as our last speaker was saying, is that incivility is a constant
yes.
in a democratic politics. But I also think that over the long haul, there are moments when Americans and politicians realize that there's some fundamental decisions being made. There's something fundamental about the nature of the republic that's being decided. The late 1790s was one of those moments when people were figuring out how democratic the nation should be. The 1850s was one of those moments when people were debating slavery. The 1960s was another one of those moments where people were really talking fundamentally about what the United States should be. And we're in another one of those moments now.
Yeah.
And during those moments, I think everything becomes heightened and polarized. And those are moments that tend to induce violence.
After the Civil War and Congress essentially resumes its business, was there as much fighting or had the fighting gone away? And it seems as if the way you describe it, at least initially, the Southern legislators were the ones that started it.
Certainly the Southerners are instigating violence all along. After, and in the epilogue of the book, I address what happens when they come back, because one of the questions everyone always asked me when I was writing it was, well, so then what happens?
Yeah, of course.
There's a war and then what? So it's interesting. So not surprisingly, the Southerners secede from the Union. They leave Washington. The violence drops. I found at one point a New York Times editorial that says, isn't it nice to be able to walk around on the street without your hand on your gun because the Southerners aren't here. When they begin to try and gain entry back into the Union, they bring violence with them. As a matter of fact, they were attacking each other in the Confederate Congress as well. But they bring violence back so that the first violent incidents that I really find after the war are Southerners. But what's really interesting is that the dynamic has fundamentally shifted, so that there's even one incident in which a Southerner canes a Northerner in – not in the Senate chamber, but in the Capitol, and has friends standing by who are also armed. It's like a reenactment of the Brooks Sumner incident.
Wow.
But the dynamics have so fundamentally changed that Northerners essentially look at that and say, really? Are we going to let these people – do we want to let these people back into the Union? I mean, these are – look at these barbarians. Do you all remember what it was like in 1858, 1859? So the Northerners have won the war. The Northerners have a kind of cultural power now, and you can see that acting out on the national stage.
Did Southerners feel that they had to be so pugilistic because they wanted to somehow send a message to their enslaved people, which is that, you know, I'm a tough guy, so don't think about an uprising?
Well, for sure, I think that over the very long haul, that's part of – I mean, violence is built into slavery. Mm-hmm. But part of what that violence does certainly is intimidate people who are enslaved and grant authority to the people who have authority in that kind of regime. And I think then Southerners voted for leaders who were those kinds of leaders. And so then it obviously infuses its way into politics, too.
That is Joanne Freeman. And again, her book is called The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. One of the things you write in the book is when the nation is polarized and civic commonality dwindles. I'm trying to read my own handwriting here. Congress reflects that image back to the American people. I mean, I think there's often a feeling like, well, that's what they're doing and I am somehow different. But you're saying, and this should not surprise anybody, that our Congress, we vote for them, they represent us.
Absolutely. And they know that. And whatever it is that they're doing, even if on the most crass level they're just thinking about their power, they still are aware of the fact that the public has influence over that power. So absolutely, I think we tend to think of national politics as a thing apart, as Congress as this institution and the Capitol as a thing apart. And in our system of government, that's just not the way it is. Now, you know, in our current politics, part of what we're debating, and although debating is a generous word for it, but accountability, public accountability is some of what we're sort of debating now. How much should there be? How is the press involved in that? But accountability from the beginning of the Republic, that the government was supposed to be accountable to the people. And if you believe in that, then absolutely Congress has to be tied in.
Are we, though, in this similar sort of turmoil of previous periods that you mentioned earlier?
Well, I mentioned that string of times where things are extreme. You know, yep. If you think about the book describes a moment of extreme polarization, distrust in national institutions of government, conspiracy theories in the press, Americans distrusting each other. It's actually striking, and particularly striking, the Telegraph. Much like social media, the Telegraph scrambles politics because it changes the way that news is spreading, and politicians no longer have quite the grip that they used to have on controlling messages. So Americans are getting news in all kinds of ways that they hadn't before, and that scrambles politics too. So that list of things, in many ways, you could check off for the present as well.
Almost out of time here, but as a historian, do you worry for our future?
Well, I do, but in this current moment, I suppose the thing that I grab at is what I'm seeing is people of all kinds becoming engaged in the political process to a degree that I don't think I've seen in my lifetime before. And looking at those other incidents over the past and other bad moments, certainly the 1790s and the 1960s, it's the political process in action that brings the nation out. And so that's where my faith is in voters and people who are taking action.
Well, Joanne Freeman, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for writing this book. Fascinating. And thanks for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, Joanne Freeman's new book is The Field of Blood, Violence in Congress and the Road to Civil War. And she's a history professor at Yale University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out more about the program including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.